Before I begin, I want to start off by thanking the congregation for allowing my family to come and worship with you and to labor amongst you for a couple of days. I can't tell you just how much refreshing it is to be here, to see a congregation that is loving, that is hardworking, and that is zealous for the Word of God and the work of His Son for His kingdom. And not just for today, but what was seen yesterday amongst the youth, a lot of people don't take time dedicated to the youth because, as Paul says, there are a lot of people that despise their youth. They overlook them because of their age and the lack of experience. But thanks to a good, strong eldership, hardworking deacons, and a loving preacher who labors, y'all, as a congregation, are training the next generation to know God. And that gives great courage to people like me who are very young. And it gives me hope for my generation and the generations to come that hopefully there won't be a generation that will arise who does not know God. And so I thank you very much, every single one of you. And for those who perhaps are not here at this time but are hearing it, thank you so much for the work that you are doing. With that being said, we are back in Proverbs chapter 6. And this morning, if you recall, we kind of did an overview of Proverbs chapters 1 through 5 to see exactly what King Solomon is referring to in chapter 6. I gave you that pretty much the outline for every chapter up to chapter 6, at least referencing it. And in chapter 1, we looked at the introduction to wisdom. In chapter 2, you see the benefits of wisdom, as well as in chapter 3, the rewards of wisdom. After talking to his son about these things, he says, "Son, you need to find counsel in wisdom," chapter 4. In chapter 5, he says, "You also need to apply this in your marriage and have a fountain of wisdom." And then in chapter 6, he says, "Let's talk about the practicality of wisdom." And I don't know about your English translation. Of course, we have to be careful with these things. The English translation is not the original. We have to, at times, go back to the Greek and Hebrew to find our definitions. But something that I do like about our English translations, although not inspired, they are helpful tools, and they're just that, tools, of certain headings above different sections in our Bibles. And I don't know about what it says in your English translation. Perhaps it's the exact same or something very similar. But above chapter 6, it has for chapter 6, parental counsel. And Solomon is giving parental counsel, parenting information to his son. And we've looked at verses 1 to 5, a parent talking to his child concerning his words. He talks to his son concerning his work ethic, verses 6 through 11. He says, "Son, I need you to consider, based off of wisdom, your heart," in verses 12 to 15. He would also say to his son, "I want you to look at wisdom and base your morals off of this wisdom," verses 16 to 19. And that's where we left off this morning. What I want to do with the time that we have, I would like to try and finish out chapter 6 and see the remainder of this parental counsel, this guidance from a father to his son, and see how can we apply it to our lives, even though this was written thousands of years ago. It's still applicable even to us today. And so what I want to do is, if you notice, if you were in our Bible class this morning, we made mention very briefly of the different types of literature throughout Scripture. You've got poetry, you've got proverbial literature, which technically falls under poetry. You've got prophetic, apocalyptic, you've got narrative, you've got a letter or epistle. And one thing I really like about poetry, and this is with any poetry, biblical or extra biblical. When you see in poetry, whether it's Hebrew poetry, English poetry, Roman poetry, no matter the poetry, there are natural breaks in the poetry, and they're usually described as lines, different lines in poetry. And if you look in Proverbs, there are natural breaks, and that's actually what our points are, the natural breaks in the text. And you can see the first break is in between verses 5 and 6, and he moves on to the next line, which talks about work ethic. When we get to our last three points, it's actually one continuous thought. Notice how he starts out in verse 20. My son, observe the commandment of your father, and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart and tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Now, even though the sentence ends there, Solomon would continue talking about this adulterous woman. And even though we're going to have three points to finish out this section, just know that Solomon prefaces this idea of the adulterous woman and the senseless sin, as he describes it in verses 27 to 35. He prefaces it with, you need to listen to what I'm about to tell you. Notice he doesn't say that with the other sections, even though it would be applicable to the other sections. It's almost like he sits his son down. He tells him, you need to consider your words, your work ethic, your heart, your purity. But then it's almost like he stops, and then he stares at his son, and he says, son, if you get anything out of this lesson, you need to make sure you listen to the commandment that I'm about to give you. You need to listen to it, and not just listen to it, bind it on your heart, wrap it around your neck, make it who you are as a person, because this commandment is going to keep you from one of the most dangerous things that is out there. It is somebody that will hunt you down. You don't even have to go looking for them. They will search you out, so you need to be on guard. In verses 20 to 23, we see the commandments to children, parents' instructions. He says, son, you need to consider wisdom in your obedience to your parents. Your parents know what they are talking about. You need to listen to us. In verses 24 to 26, he says, the reason you need to listen to us is because there is one who is called the harlot, the adulteress, and she is hunting. The hunting of a harlot. Pursue not the evil woman, Solomon says. He says, you need to consider your purity. Verses 24 to 26. And then finally, he closes out 27 to 35. Senseless sin. The punishment for adultery. He says, you need to consider your actions in wisdom. Now, let's look at verses 20 to 23 in greater detail. One thing I love, I mean, I absolutely adore about the Bible is that it is not boring if you know how to read it. I know that personally, for the first half of my life, I really struggled in reading the Bible. I grew up on the King James and New King James and the ASV of 1901. I love Old English, Shakespearean language. It's very beautiful to hear. But if you're not used to it, and even if you are used to it, at times, if you just go and just read Shakespeare, if you are not in love with that type of literature, it'll become very dull very fast. And I remember I was actually homeschooled. All of my siblings were homeschooled. And some of our requirements for our schooling was you need to make sure you read your Bible every single day. And I'm glad that my parents made us read our Bible. But something that I wish that I could go back and change was how I read my Bible. because they said, we want you to read so many chapters. Or they would say, we want you to read for an hour. And so if it was so many chapters, I would speed read those chapters just so I can be done reading it. So I can say, hey, I did my job as a follower of Christ, as a student of the scriptures. I read my Bible today and I even got in a few chapters. That's more than most people. Well, if it was an hour, I would take my time. I wouldn't even pay attention. I might even doze off and I'd be looking back at the clock. Okay, I still got 30 more minutes. Okay, 25. Man, when is this going to end? And it took me a while to figure out how to read the Bible. There is a story of a young woman. And as she was a young lady, she loved reading books. She actually grew up to be a critic of literature. And at times, she would try to write her own books. She loved to read and write. She learned the different types of literature. She went to universities and colleges just so she can get an education in how to be a better student of books. Well, she came across these books at a garage sale, and that's what she would do. She'd love to read old books. And she came across this book that didn't look fancy at all. The cover didn't even have a picture. It had some boring title on it. Didn't know the author from anybody. It wasn't a famous author. And so she thought, you know what? I'll try to give it a shot. And so she buys the whole box of books and she takes it home and she opens up this book, and as she's reading it, the first page, just the preface of the book, she loses her spot because it's so boring. And so she says, okay, maybe I'm just tired. Let me go back and reread it. She would go back and try to reread it and she'd lose her spot again. She'd go back, and finally, after the fifth time, she says, this is ridiculous. This is the worst author I have ever read in my entire life. So she takes this book, she puts it in a box that says garage sale, and it gets put in the garage, and then ultimately gets thrown up in the attic, and she completely forgets about this book. Time goes on. She ends up dating an individual. And they found something in common. They loved books. And so as they began to date, they fell in love with one another, and they got engaged. They were engaged to be married. And as they went on a date, they said, you know, this is our last date before we are to be wed. And so on this date, they did something very special. They said, I want you to tell me something that you have never told anybody ever before. And the young woman, she said, I'll tell you. She said, you know, you know my love for books. And she said, I try to write books. And there was this book that I tried to write. And his eyes lit up. He says, really? He says, I'm an author. And I write books. He said, I've stopped writing books just because of the time. But I actually published two or three different books. And she was just amazed. Why didn't you tell me this? And he said, well, I didn't actually go by my name. I had a pen name. And she says, what was this pen name? Well, he gave her the pen name, and she said, that sounds very familiar. What is this pen name? And he says, well, the title of this book, and he gave the title of the book, and sure enough, it was that boring, dull title. She couldn't believe it. She got home. She kissed him goodnight. He went his way. She went back in. And she made a beeline to the garage. She was throwing boxes. She was opening them up, throwing everything of the contents out, trying to find this book. And she realized it's in the attic. She gets in the attic, throws everything out. She finally sees the book. She takes it, goes downstairs, turns on the lamp. She sits down, and she begins reading. And it's about 7 o'clock in the evening at this time. And she reads, and she reads, and she can't put it down. And by the time she gets done reading, it's 7 o'clock the next morning. What was the difference? The book never changed. She fell in love with the author. How can I take the commandments of my Father, and I apply them, and I make them who I am as a person? You've got to fall in love with the author first. You have to know the individual who wrote it. You've got to get to know them and fall in love with who they are, because the love of God moves men to repentance. And if you fall in love with God, guess what you're going to fall in love with? You're going to fall in love with His book. And you won't be able to put it down. Now, Brother Obed, we made mention earlier, I was talking with him a second ago. And as I was reading through this section, 20 to 23, my mind couldn't believe what I was reading. And I made, before, you're probably wondering, wait a minute, you were about to make a point earlier, and then you told this story. Remember I said one thing I love about the Bible is that it's not boring if you know how to read it. You can teach something in Bible class and then preach a sermon and not have any plan on making any connection with the Bible class or the sermon. I want you to turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 6 real quick. Deuteronomy chapter 6, starting in verse 1. If you recall in our Bible class this morning, we discussed an overview of the book of Deuteronomy. And we noted that one of the main foundational thoughts of the book of Deuteronomy was something called to the Jews. They knew it as the Shema. The Shema was really the greatest commandment. Now notice what it says starting in verse 1. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God. Oh, wait a minute. The fear the Lord your God? What's the purpose of life? Fear God and keep His commandments. Let's keep reading. Notice what it says. The commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Notice the commandment that will prolong their days and that they must fear. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord your God of your fathers has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall, now notice this, this is the connection, shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets on your forehead. You shall write them on your doorposts, and your house, and your gates. What is the proverb writer, the father, doing for his son? He's following the commandments that were told to the Israelites long ago. You need to fear God and keep His commandments. He says, son, you need to fall in love with the author, because the author has given you commandments, something to read, something that you need to make a part of you, that you need so much so that you need to bind it around your neck, put it in your heart, that it may be frontless between your eyes. Wherever you go, whether you are lying down when you're sleeping, when you rise up, it shall talk to you. When you walk, it'll walk with you. Why do I need to fall in love with God? Because there's somebody else that's trying to make you fall in love with them. Notice verse 24, hunting of a harlot. He says, you need to look at your purity. Why do I need to keep these things? Well, notice verse 23, for the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light. Psalm 119:105. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. Notice this. And reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Now listen, what has Solomon just told his son? He says there's two different types of people that you're, one of the two you're going to fall in love with. Either you're going to fall in love with God, and you are going to love the things that He says with His mouth, or you're going to fall in love with someone called the strange woman, the adulteress, which if you look in the Old Testament, this word strange doesn't mean weird. I've been called weird my entire life. You know, and in fact, I know my dad said, "Man, you're a weird kid." It's like, where do you think I got it from, Daddy? Well, it's not talking about that kind of weird, kind of peculiar. This word strange, you find it in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 10 and verses 1 through 4. Nadab and Abihu offered up strange fire before God. That word strange means unauthorized. He says there is an authorized lover, God, one that loves you with all his heart, and he wants you to love him with all your heart. But there is an unauthorized lover, and she is known as the adulteress. Don't listen to her words. You need to listen to the words of God. Now notice this. Notice the description of this woman. To keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress, do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. He doesn't beat around the bush. He says, look, son, this individual, they look good. Sin looks good. It tastes good. It sounds good. It feels good. But that doesn't mean that it is good. He says, you need to be careful because looks can be deceiving. Notice if you look through this passage and then turn to the next chapter, chapter 7, and notice starting in verse 13 of chapter 7, the way she approaches these young men. It says, so she seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows. Notice how she approaches the young man. I'm godly. I offer up sacrifices to God. I am at peace with God. I am a woman that you need to be looking for. Because just as your parents told you to look for godly women, I just came back from offering sacrifices. Well, let's keep reading. Therefore, I have come to meet you. I am a godly woman seeking a godly man. Notice what she says. Therefore, I've come to meet you to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. For my husband is not at home, and he has gone on a long journey. And he has taken a bag of money with him, and at the full moon he will come home. With her many persuasions, she entices him. Now notice what she has just done. She has presented herself in such a way that seems godly. And then notice what she says about her own husband. She admits that she's married. And she says, but he's abandoned me. I'm all alone. I'm in need of help. I need emotional support here. And notice, I have come to seek you specifically. I need you. It's not just any old man. I need you. She targets an individual. But it's because she sees the weakness in him. You see that by Solomon in verse 7. A young man lacking sense, verse 7. Well, she says, if you come to my place, it's already for you. I have already made preparations for you. Let's go back to chapter 6. Notice, do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. Notice what he says not to do. Let me see, back up here. Notice what he tells his son not to let go, his heart. Don't let her capture your heart. What does the psalmist say? Thy word hath I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the way of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. Psalm 1. But notice this. What does he say? Blessed is the man who does not do these things, does not walk, does not sit, does not seek counsel in, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and he meditates day and night. Notice, you've got two different types of lovers in Psalm 1. You either will love the counsel of the wicked, or you will love the counsel of God. And depending on who you allow in your heart is going to determine your outcome. Now notice the terminology, verse 26. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. There, this passage in the Hebrew is a little difficult to translate, and so different English translations have different ways of transliterating it, I guess you could say. Here it says that a man is reduced to a loaf of bread. Some translations will say, paraphrasing, you can purchase an individual for some bread. The point that Solomon is making here, he says, this is what happens with a prostitute. This is what happens with one that's married. In both situations, it's not good. The point that he's making with the harlot in verse 26 is, you are reduced to poverty. All you can offer her is bread. You will run out of your monetary value trying to seek out pleasure. And with the adulterous woman, she's not necessarily looking for money. She's looking for something else. She's looking for your precious life. You can be reduced to simply bread. And not only that, you can have your precious life taken away from you. Now notice something else. And an adulteress, verse 26, hunts. You know, I love to go hunting. In fact, I was telling Obed and a few other brethren this afternoon my love for hunting, specifically hunting raccoons. And I really like to go hunting for deer, but any chance I get to hunt a raccoon, it's on. And maybe it's just my Tennessee roots, I don't know. But when you go hunting, you don't just think, okay, I think I'm just going to go hunting. There's preparation. You have to know the target. You have to know their pattern. You have to know what they eat, what they don't eat, what they like, what they don't like, things that scare them and spook them, things that'll draw them in and bring them a comfort and put them at ease. And then once you have them set in the trap, they're done. It's over. The adulteress knows how to lure in young individuals. Why do I make mention of that? Well, look at chapter 7 again in verse 6. For at the window of my house, Solomon says, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive. Notice what he says. And discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense, passing through the streets near her corner. Well, wait a minute. We haven't gotten there yet, but he already makes mention of what it means to lack sense in chapter 6. Let's keep reading here. Verse 32 of chapter 6. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. You know, we already referenced this morning Luke chapter 15 and verse 17 with the prodigal son. It says, when he came to his senses, he realized, I'm eating slop. I need to go back to my father. I need to go back to the one who truly loves me, because I blew my money. I was reduced to a loaf of bread, and I wasted my inheritance on the world. He says, son, don't do this. Now, if you are a teenager, or anything like I was when I was, at least some point in my teenage experience, I guess you could say. For a while, my parents were wise until they weren't, and that was according to my judgment. And it wasn't until I hit my teenage years that I gained all the wisdom in the world. And I thought, they have no idea what they're talking about. The culture's changed. They're so out of touch with the youth because they're not youth anymore. They have no idea what it's like. And who are they to tell me that I can't be around these types of people and it'll affect me? I can handle myself. Well, it's not until you are prudent in that kind of mindset that you realize, wow, mom and dad were right. Where does King Solomon have any right to talk about any of these things? Turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11. In 1 Kings chapter 11, I want you to read something with me, starting in verse 1. It's a very sad passage because it is about a man who had every opportunity, who had literal wisdom given to him by God after he asked for it. And this is how he uses his wisdom. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughters of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they shall surely turn your heart away after their gods." Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after their other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. You can almost hear Rehoboam, "Dad, who are you to tell me this?" He says, "This is how I am able to tell you this. I have experienced it with my own life." In Ecclesiastes, he says, "It's vain. It's vanity. It's like trying to grasp at air. There's no use in it. The only thing you have to look forward to is death." Look at verse 27 of chapter 6. "Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched?" I really appreciate this congregation, as we mentioned earlier, because of y'all's dedication to the youth. I remember back in Tennessee, our youth group was very strong for a while. And eventually, it got to the point where parents were starting to allow their children to participate in things that they ought really not to. And it didn't start out very, very bad and in your face. It was very little at a time, which is really how Satan gets you. And it got to a point where you would see them go to prom. And they weren't doing anything, but they were just there because that's where their friends were. Well, the next year came. And now, okay, well, it wasn't that bad last year. So let's see if we can kind of do a little bit more. "Mom, Dad, would it be all right if I got a dress that was like my friend's?" "Well, what about the young man?" "Dad, you know, I'm bringing my date, but, you know, she's not really dressed as modest as she was last year. But I promise we're not going to do anything. Haley and I have a 2-year-old and 2.5-year-old son and one on the way. I couldn't imagine asking my little 2.5-year-old son to pour gasoline on himself and walk as close to our fireplace as he possibly could without catching fire. In fact, if I were to do that, I would be thrown in prison. I would probably have the death penalty. But yet, spiritually speaking, we douse our children in gasoline and say, try to get as close to the fire without getting caught." The proverb writer says, "Who can do that?" He says, "I tried that with 1,000 different women, and it didn't work." Don't do it, son. It's not worth it. Now notice, we'll close with this last point. Starting in verse 27, I know we already looked over this passage, but 27 to verse 35, to the end of the chapter, you have senseless sin, punishment for adultery. He says, "Son, you need to consider your actions before you actually put them into action. Be careful where you put your prudence," is what he's saying. Notice in verse 29, "So is the one who goes to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry. But when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give many gifts. This is a very sobering passage. Number one, because of 27 and 28, the analogy given that we just looked at a moment ago. I challenge you, those who are parents, perhaps even grandparents, who may have some influence on your grandchildren, make sure that you encourage your children and grandchildren not to hold hot coals and think, I'm not going to catch on fire. What you need to do is say, that's hot, don't touch it. If they decide to do it, you show them verses 29 to 35. You say, if you do this, you're lacking sense. You know, growing up, I really wish I could tell you the story of the raccoon. It would make a lot more sense of who I am as a person. Obed and Char are already laughing. But if you knew me as a kid, and even now, there are times where people look at me and be like, dude, how are you still alive? Like, that's stupid. Not as immature as I was when I was younger. But I remember when I was growing up, my grandfather would tell me, son, you need to use your head for something other than a hat rack. And then I would also hear my daddy tell me when I would go and do something stupid, he would say, son, that made so little sense, you need some change back. And I'd think, what does that mean? And he would tell me, you'll figure it out one day. Reading verse 29, a father is telling his son, son, going after your neighbor's wife makes so little sense, you're going to need some change back. It is going to kill you. There's nothing good that comes out of sleeping with somebody else's wife. And you know what? There is the immediate context with your neighbor. But there's also a spiritual context of this with God. You know, if you look at Ephesians chapter 5, how is the church and Christ described? It's described as a bride with her groom. Husbands, love your wives as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. Well, at the very end of that context, at the end of chapter 5, he says, this saying is a mystery, but I'm referring to Christ in the church. Essentially, have you ever heard, maybe Obed has done this, I know I do it quite a bit, where you're making a point in your sermon, and you think, oh, this is a good point, and then you give the point, and you say, you know, this one's free, I'm not going to charge you for this one. And then you get back to the main point you were talking about. That's what Paul does in Ephesians chapter 5. He says, you know what, this one's a freebie, I'm not going to charge you for this one. Husbands and wives, do this. But my main point is referring to Christ in the church. I want you to put Christ and the church in this scenario. Look at how the Hebrew writer would describe one who does not go unpunished, who goes after his neighbor's wife. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Notice what the Hebrew writer says. It says, marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. You know, this little word all, I heard one preacher tell me, you can't get aller than all. This includes everybody. There's not one person that gets out of that little tidbit of information on the day of judgment. Well, look, I was ignorant. I wasn't even a part of this law. And so I'm kind of excluded from this. God says, absolutely not. I instituted marriage at the beginning. I told you what it was supposed to be like. I gave you an example of what it's supposed to be like through my son in the church. You've got no excuse. Now notice, whoever touches her will not go unpunished. It doesn't matter how well you hide it. It will come out. Whether in this life or on the day of judgment, God says, I remember with my granddaddy, he lives in Tennessee, him and my Papo, Nana and Papo is what I call them. I would always try to play jokes on my granddaddy because he's a huge, huge prankster. And about Tommy's age, I would try to creep up behind him in his recliner. And of course, I'm not quiet. I don't know how to be quiet, but I think that I am a ninja. Okay, if I stay still, I go invisible. That's how good of a sneaker I am. Well, I'm walking up to my granddad, and he always has his hands like this, and he has his eyes closed. And you would know when he's asleep because he would have his mouth open snoring. That's when you knew he was asleep. So I would wait, and I would wait until his mouth opened up, and then the snoring began. And he doesn't like to be tickled. He hates it. Well, I try to go up and grab his leg and try to tickle him. Well, what I didn't see was this. He had his eye open. I was too focused on this, and I was thinking, you know what? I've got him. As soon as I went to grab him, he grabbed my arm. He said, "What are you doing, son?" That's what it's like on the day of judgment. In fact, while he held me, before he initiated judgment, he said, "You can't pull the wool over my eyes, son." We can't pull the wool over God's eyes. The darkness is like daylight to him. Every deed and every word and every careless thought is going to be brought to the light. And what is it said about the light in the book of John? The darkness hates the light because it exposes its works. Well, it doesn't matter how good of a ninja you are with your sin. God, you may think his eyes are closed, but his all-seeing eye is everywhere. And he says, "What are you doing, son? You can't pull the wool over my eyes. I'm going to have to pass judgment on you if you don't come to your senses." Well, notice this. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry. But when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. Now keep reading closer to the end here. "For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give many gifts." Now remember a second ago, we just made mention of there's the immediate application, which is with your neighbor, your literal neighbor, your fellow man. But then there is the spiritual application to this. Can you imagine if Anthony Sherfus cheated on my wife with another man's wife, and he finds out about it, and I say, "Hey, look, man, I don't want there to be any hard feelings between us. Why don't we go out and get a cheeseburger? I'll pay for your lunch. I'll give you some gifts to try and make up for it." Do you think he's going to be like, "Okay, that's fine. I didn't know you were such a good dude. I'm very glad that we can have this relationship." Absolutely not. At least not a good husband would respond that way. Imagine the bride of Christ. Imagine his bride cheating on him. Do you really think on the day of judgment, when it's found out and they didn't come to their senses, that the bride is going to say, "Well, wait a minute, let me give you some gifts to make up for it"? Christ is going to say, "No. No, that's not how this works. You didn't come to your senses, therefore I'm cutting you off. And my true bride, those who were actually faithful to me, they are coming with me. You are reduced to a loaf of bread. You're going to see poverty for all of eternity." If you were to look at the book of Proverbs, the book of good actions, you see a book of knowledge, wisdom, and prudence. Solomon telling his son Rehoboam, "I have knowledge and wisdom, but son, I did not have prudence. Look at my life as an example. Read my books and learn from them. And know this is how you need to live your life, not this way." You know, looking at Proverbs chapter 6, I couldn't imagine standing before God and having to look him in the eye and say, I mistreated your bride. I slandered her name. Can I give you something to make up for it? You know, there is a story about my daddy while he was in preaching school. And him and a few other preachers, they went on a hiking trip. And in this hiking trip, there was also an opportunity to go cave diving. And in this endeavor of going down into caves, they had warning signs. If you were pregnant, if you were claustrophobic, if you had all these things, it was, if you do this, we're not liable. You don't need to do it. In fact, you need to sign a waiver before you do this. And so all these preachers were signing waivers saying, if I die, it's my fault. And they had the helmet, they had the light put on the helmet, and the guide began to go down to the cave. And it started out pretty big, and then it began to get narrow and narrow and narrow, until eventually you had to get on the ground and curl up, and you had to slowly itch your way like a worm under this little crevice until it came into this clearing. And everybody came through, and the guide said, how many here has been in total darkness before? And everybody raised their hand, and he just began to laugh. He says, you've never been in total darkness before. He said, we're about 800 feet deep into the earth. What I want you to do is turn your light off, and I want you to tell me what you see. Well, everybody turns their light off, and all you can hear are the voices, and it begins to echo. And the guide said, can anybody see anything? And there were a few people, yeah, I think I can see. I can make out the cleft of this rock. In fact, I can kind of see your face. And he just began to belly laugh. He says, you can't see anything, because he was right behind them when they said that. He said, what's happening is your brain is replaying the very last thing you saw, trying to find that light, because it can't comprehend complete darkness, because you've been so used to seeing everything. On the day of judgment, there are those who are so used to this certain life, this lifestyle, and the very last thing they're going to see is the light of the glory of Christ. And he's going to say, depart from me, I never knew you. And they're going to be cast into outer darkness. And they're going to be saying, I can still see him even though he's not there. Because in their minds, they're trying to replay the very last thing they saw, which was Jesus Christ and what they almost had. He says, he who does this lacks sense. Don't be one who needs change back. Be one that has treasure in heaven, because you were faithful to your groom, Jesus the Christ. What are you doing with the wisdom that is given to you by your heavenly Father? Are you being prudent with it? Are you applying it? Are you staying away from the one that is trying to hunt you down? It is said in 1 Peter, be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary the devil is seeking about, roaming around, seeking whom he may devour. Are you allowing Satan to hunt you down so that he can devour you? Or are you saying, I'm not going to walk, sit, or even stand by this type of counsel? Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight, his joy, his happiness is in the law of God, is in his purpose in life. Maybe you have forgotten your purpose. You have fallen away. Or maybe you have been walking aimlessly in the dark, trying to figure out where is the light. And you finally see a glimmer of hope because that wisdom is shining. It's calling out in the streets. And you have a choice to make. Am I going to be baptized for the remission of my sins after I repent of them first? Making the great confession that I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one, and that he is the Son of God, and that for the remission of my sins, I can be baptized and added to the church of Christ by God himself. Acts chapter 2 and verse 47. Well, no matter the case, we have people, brethren here, Christians that are eager to see you become a part of the family or come back home to the family like the prodigal son, the one who came to his senses. Whatever the case may be, I beg and plead that you come now as together we stand and as we sing.